It's that time of year again. The time filled with advertisements meant to inspire loneliness. Commercially driven events intended to make you feel like a loser. And societal demands that you never wanted nor asked for. That's right. It's Valentine's Day. The worst of all holidays. Which, ironically, makes it the perfect time of year for a scary home companion to celebrate, well, not love, but something love-adjacent. Fetishes. Hold on, don't click away. This isn't that kind of show. I'm not going to be listing off or diving into the weird and kinky fetishes that exist. I mean to speak of them hypothetically. Because when you get down to brass tacks, who or what the fetish is about, they're all kind of the same. A fetish is a sexual obsession, focused on either an object, an activity, or a part of the body not generally associated with sex. A person with a fetish often requires this object or activity in order to get satisfaction. It could be socks, elbows, mouse traps, watermelons, vacuum cleaner suction hoses, or just a good old-fashioned freshly baked apple pie. There's one thing that unites all these fetishes: the fixation. This need, this ever-growing dependence on the fetish for any kind of sexual satisfaction. The vast majority of fetishes are essentially harmless. But some of them venture away from the shores of mere weirdness, across the sea of what the fuck, and into a land more sinister. Mitch Kemp was a man with one such fetish. Mitch had a good job, a nice house. Outwardly, he seemed as right as rain. But Mitch had a secret. He had a sexual predilection for crime scenes. Drinking whiskey in the kitchen and telling scary stories around the fire. Music, monsters and mayhem. Killers, cannibals and cults. Fearful fiction and furious fact. Tall tales and terrifying truths. This is A Scary Home Companion. There's no doubt that Mitchell Kemp was a weird motherfucker. But that doesn't mean that his story shouldn't be explained in its own terms. Mitch Kemp had a very vanilla upbringing. No behavior problems, no issues with his family life. He did well in school, he was well behaved. He was that most dreadful of all words, normal. Just a normal kid. And then one day he stumbled across something grisly, and it had a profound influence over his developing mind. Mitch and one of his friends were playing in an abandoned warehouse near their neighborhood. They had been forbidden to visit this place, both by their parents and the law, and yet they did it anyway. On the second floor, while wandering about in the midst of hide-and-seek, Mitch found a dead body. This was no accidental death. Even such a young man could clearly see that. The woman had been bludgeoned with a cinder block, which still lay in pieces like a halo around her head. Mitch was so upset that he turned tail and ran all the way home, leaving his friend still in that hiding spot. Several days later, Mitch went back to the same building. By this point, the police had come and taken the body away, leaving the scene decorated with festive yellow crime scene tape. Which was fine, because Mitch didn't want to see the body again. That part had traumatized him. But still, he was drawn back by something else, by that feeling. And he realized that as he stood in the same room, this place where a horribly violent death had occurred, that the feeling was still there. Pinpricks up the back of his neck, tracing all the way down his spine. His heart rate increased. His breathing became shallow. Although Mitch didn't know how to define what was happening to him, he also experienced his first real erection. This proved to be the single most formative experience of Mitch's young life, one that would dictate the future of his sexuality. Although at the time, he didn't know that. How could he? He didn't even know what sex was at this point in his life. He just knew that feeling. But then, to be fair, isn't this how human sexuality works in the sum and total? Who among us have ever made a conscious choice about who or what we were attracted to? Men, women, tall, short, white, black, fat, thin? No. We don't get to choose these things. They are somehow chosen for us, either by nature, nurture, or a little bit of both. And so it was for young Mitch, who wound up having a devil of a time in his teenage years because he was very, very confused. The girls didn't seem to move the needle for him. But the boys didn't either. Like everyone else his age, Mitch was bursting at the seams with hormones and desires. And yet, he didn't know what for. Because nobody really did it for him. And that's because Mitch wasn't after a person. He was after a feeling. That feeling that he had only gotten at the crime scene. When he was 17 years old, Mitch got his second piece of data. When you only have one piece of data, it's impossible to suss out a pattern. But two pieces, well, now you've got a line. A line that can point you in a direction. For Halloween that year, Mitch and a couple of his buddies went to a local haunted house, one with a very interesting and very real backstory. In 1998, the house had been the residence of famous author Neil Wallis, who, for no reason that anybody could understand, went and turned devil on his family and killed them all. But he didn't just kill them. He eviscerated them and tied them together by the guts around a maypole. It was a crime that rocked the state and still echoed through popular culture. So it was the perfect setting for a haunted house. For Mitch, it was anything but scary. As soon as he stepped into the darkened front hallway of the Wallis house, that old feeling returned. He stumbled through the rooms, holding his hands in front of his crotch so that his buddies wouldn't see the tent. A week later, Halloween was long gone. And the place was sitting empty again. So Mitch went back, alone. He spent a little private time inside. He took off his clothes and wandered around buck naked, furiously masturbating like he never had before. But here is the interesting part. Sure, we've all heard about psychos jerking off at the sights of their crimes. Yes, it's part and parcel of being a sexually driven madman. But this wasn't that. This was something else, because Mitch hadn't committed a crime. He didn't want to commit a crime. And in fact, he knew very little of the details surrounding the Wallace murders, which had mostly been kept under wraps by the authorities. Which meant Mitch wasn't picturing the victims in his head. He wasn't reliving the murders. It wasn't like that at all. His mind was beautifully blank. His thoughts perfectly empty. He was so engulfed in the feeling of the house that it eclipsed him entirely. Being in this place, being at the scene of horrific violence, that's what aroused him. In fact, it was the only thing that aroused him. Over the next 2 years, Mitch returned frequently to the Wallace house, late at night. It was, in his estimation, a deeply rewarding sex life. But eventually, he wanted more. As his friends went away to college, Mitch started following his own 5-year plan. He took an entry-level position with the most respected cleaning company in the city. He learned everything that he could, specializing in higher-end jobs like businesses and medical facilities. After 2 years, Mitch went into business for himself. He took any and all jobs. He worked 80, 90-hour weeks. He glad-handed all of his clients. He built a rep. This was all part of his 5-year plan, which paid off in magnificent fashion. Mitch had been in business for himself for about 3 years when he put in his first bid with the police department to be their on-call crime scene cleanup specialist. This is what it was all about. Now, Mitch had immediate access to all the goriest places in the area when they were fresh. And it was easy for him to lowball the competition with his bids because, of course, this wasn't about money for Mitch. This was about something money couldn't buy. That feeling. Mitch would make sure that he was alone, the place was secure, and then get naked and have some good times. But only after he had cleaned the scene. Mitch actually preferred a clean crime scene because the feeling wasn't predicated on blood spatter or mess. It was soaked into the walls in a deeper way. Then he would make an impression of the key so that he could make a copy and let himself back in whenever he needed. The 5-year plan was a roaring fucking success. Mitch was a happy man. And although he wasn't wealthy, he made a reasonable living. Moreover, he had cultivated a reputation for excellent, fast work on even the messiest of assignments. And that is what put him on the radar of the DRO. For those of you not familiar, the DRO is the Department of Restricted Operations, better known as Deep Red Ops. The DRO was a sort of sister organization to the FBI and the CIA, albeit the kind of sister who burns herself with cigarettes and smothers the babies she is sitting. Deep Red Ops handled the wet work and fringe science that was too heinous even for the FBI or the CIA. Much like the police department, the DRO had a need for crime scene cleanup specialists. And their scenes were not only more bloody and upsetting, but they were also highly classified. Mitch was scouted. He was recruited. He was analyzed and given a battery of psychological tests. When all was said and done, he was hired on a probationary basis. Although this was not a part of Mitch's plan, it was a part of someone's plan. You see, Deep Red Ops has a long and infamous history of employing people that have, shall we say, a certain moral flexibility. It didn't take the DRO agents very long to suss out Mitch's extracurricular activities, but that actually made him a much more attractive prospect for this job. The DRO hired the damaged, the deranged, the off-kilter, because they found such people easier to control and manipulate. Also, it didn't hurt that Mitch was single, a childless loner, so if something were to happen and he were to disappear, who'd notice? For his final interview, Mitch was taken to a remote DRO holding facility. He signed a series of non-disclosure agreements and was duly warned that if he ever violated them and spoke publicly about his work or about who employed him, then Mitch would most certainly wind up in a place like this. Mitch didn't have to think twice. He signed the paperwork with a trembling hand, while his other hand stayed in his lap. He didn't know what had happened in this facility before, but his cock was engorged to the point of being painful. Like, this whole place was one giant crime scene. And knowing the DRO, it probably was. They gave him a hefty signing bonus and 3 weeks lead time on his first assignment. In that time, Mitch liquidated his business. He handed his client list off to a friendly rival, and then he took a little vacation, something he'd been planning for a while, a trip to Chicago. First, he spent an hour in the brownstone where the Pagan family had been shot to death the year before. And then he visited the apartment where Richard Speck had killed those 8 nurses back in 1966. He found that both crime scenes had a markedly different flavor to them. When Mitch went back home, he was relaxed, refreshed, and ready to enter the next phase of his life. Well, he thought he was ready. But nobody could have been fully prepared for what came later. This was the next level of crime scene cleanup. Hell, it couldn't even be called crime scene cleanup because none of these places were considered to be crime scenes. They were something much darker. Heinous experiments and projects that would never be exposed or investigated, that would never see the light of day. Welcome to Deep Red Ops. Orlando, Omaha, Oklahoma City, always moving, always on the go. Memphis, Miami, Mount Vernon. Mitch was still in his probationary period. He worked with a handler named Tyrone and three other men. Tyrone schooled them about the job. After 6 months, you would either get promoted to field janitor, working alone, or they would let you go. Tyrone explained this to them while they were in a hidden room beneath a hospital. There were no bodies here. There was no blood spatter. At first, Mitch didn't see what they needed to clean up. But there was that feeling, that tingly feeling in his fingers and toes, that sultry, rich itch on the back of his neck, the stirring in his loins that told him very bad things had happened here. Indianapolis, Idaho Falls, Interlaken, Boston, Baltimore, Birmingham. Mitch was not a real agent for Deep Red Ops, nor would he ever be. Tyrone explained that he was a handler for new janitorial recruits. But after that 6-month probationary period, if Mitch was kept on, he would answer to a new handler. Just one person, who might not even give his name. Tyrone had a handler of his own. Deep Red Ops had a strict chain of command, where nobody knew any more than they needed to. Biohazard suits were mandatory, just part of the gear. There were new types of chemicals and cleaning agents to remove stains that many times did not seem to be fully human. After dealing with so many murders and vicious assaults, Mitch found himself at loose ends trying to identify exactly what the fuck he was cleaning up. Tucson, Tulsa, Tampa, Tallahassee. Holy shit, why did they go to Florida so much? Churches, schools, suburban basements, high-rise penthouses, jail cells, black site holding tanks, surgical suites, sex dungeons, and so many laboratories. By the end of the 6 months, it was down to just Mitch and Tyrone. The other three had either quit or been let go. Tyrone didn't say, and Mitch didn't ask. He sussed out that this wasn't a job where asking questions behooved him. So he never asked about the other guys. He didn't ask about what exactly he was cleaning up. He didn't ask about the biodegradable evidence bags that he filled by the hundred, or why they were all sent north to Abilene, Vermont. And then it was over. He passed. Mitch was out of the probationary period. Tyrone met him, handed him a burner phone, and shook his hand goodbye forever. 2 days later, that phone rang, and Mitch got his first solo assignment. The work continued. Now would be a good time to mention that Mitch was feeling a bit frustrated. This was a very serious job, so Mitch knew that he couldn't stick to his old pattern of returning to the crime scenes. Some of the places he cleaned up were still occupied. Others were being actively watched. So Mitch had to take a knee. He had to take a little break from his true passion. He would soak up that feeling all day long and then go home, get naked, and try to finish himself. And it worked, you know, but it was far from satisfying. Mitch knew that he needed a vacation to indulge in his desires. But he waited for a little while. He just fucking started this job, so he knew that asking for time off would make him look bad. He wanted this job. He needed this job. Not just for the money, but for the potential. He had discovered a whole new level of crime scene, and he couldn't just walk away from that. To Mitch, it was as if he had spent his life banging fives and sixes, and now he was working with straight-up perfect tens and couldn't make a move. After sending his latest batch of evidence bags to Abilene, Mitch spoke to his handler. Even after 3 months of steady work, Mitch didn't know the name of the man on the phone. "Sir, I think I need a little break. Do we get PTO?" "2 weeks a year." "Tyrone didn't tell you?"
"He didn't tell me much."
"Sure. Take your 2 weeks, Mitchell. You've been doing good work, especially considering your, predilection."
"Excuse me?"
"We know, Mitch. We've known all along. So you can color me tickled pink that you've managed to keep it in your pants so far. That's commendable. That's professionalism, Mitch. And we see that in you."
"What?
"Please, Mitch. You think that you're the only one to ever get that special sensation when you're at a hot scene? You're not. You do possess more self-control than most. So yes, Mitch, take your 2 weeks. See the sights. I recommend taking the Bundy Trail."
What? What's that? How do you know about the Bundy Trail?"
"We know everything, Mitch. I'll call you in 2 weeks with your next assignment. And remember,
For God's sakes, clean up after yourself. In 1974, notorious serial killer Ted Bundy left a trail of victims throughout the Pacific Northwest. By fetishists and serial killer geeks alike, it was called the Bundy Trail. The crime scenes can be followed up the coast, starting in Eugene, through Corvallis, Portland, Olympia, Tacoma, and finally, Seattle. This had long been Mitch's idea for a dream vacation, and now, apparently, his boss had signed off on it. There was no reason to look a gift horse in the mouth, so Mitch packed his bags, booked a flight to Portland, and then rented a car to drive south to Eugene and get started. Some of these murder sites were outside, in the woods. And this was new for Mitch. He was used to being indoors. But he quickly came to learn that it didn't matter. The emotional resonance left behind after a tragedy couldn't be confined to walls and a roof. It could be anywhere. Mitch had 2 weeks. So he took his sweet time. He visited all of Bundy's murder sites and enjoyed himself repeatedly at each of them. And then the day came. Oh, no. Oh, shit. Oh, fuck me. It was over. And then that eerie, dreary Christmas afternoon feeling settled over him. It was time. He had to wrap it up and go home and go back to work. And then, best case scenario, he could take another vacation in a year. A year which seemed impossibly long in Mitch's post-orgasmic haze. No. Wait. Wait a second. There were still 3 days left in this vacation. Mitch had time to do something else, to find someplace new, to feel that feeling just one more time. Seattle, Washington is home to many different horror shows and urban legends, but one of them sat at the top of the heap. The top result on his first Google search gave Mitch everything that he wanted. If he was in Seattle, he needed to visit the home of Martin Rose, the hand collector. And here's why. Martin Rose wasn't a killer. He captured women, he cut off their hand, and then he bandaged them up and released them. He used his same crummy walk-up apartment as the surgical suite for all of his procedures. Not only was it a famous story, but it was a novel twist on the norm for Mitch, because he couldn't help but think, would the feeling be the same at a crime scene like this? Would it have a different flavor? Mitch drove past the row house apartment building, which had been abandoned and sealed up tight. Even from the street, he could feel the first touches of the tingle in his fingers and toes. Oh yeah, this place was special. This deep into his fetish trip, Mitch couldn't resist, and he sure as shit couldn't wait. He couldn't even muster the self-control to watch the place for a while and make sure that it was safe. He legit did not give a fuck. That turgid beast between his legs, that's what was calling the shots now. He parked two blocks away and walked up to the back of the building. To his surprise, he had to physically break in. He had assumed that the local homeless population would have broken in many times over. But it seemed that what was a beacon to Mitch was a warning cry to everyone else. He went to the second floor. Even though he knew the room number that he was after, he would have spotted it anyway. There was a strange red mold growing on the door. There were wisps and hints of the maroon dust everywhere. But on this door, it grew so thick it looked like one giant scab. Mitch gloved up and put on a mask, just in case, and then edged the door open with his foot. Inside, the room was eclipsed by this mold, so thick that patches of it pushed out away from the walls in bulbous formations that looked like blood-stained coral. Floor to ceiling, it was everywhere. But in one spot, on one wall, it was different. Darker, heavier, deeper somehow, as if it was growing into the wall instead of away from it. And curious, it was in a rough, broken oval shape, which reminded Mitch of a door. Normally, he would have turned and walked out of there. His thin little face mask wasn't any assurance against this unknown mold on the walls. But there was nothing normal about this. Because he had never felt fucking anything this strong before. He couldn't help himself. He stripped nude down to the mask. He paced the room, stroking himself, mumbling and drooling down his chin. This was like mainlining pure heroin after a lifetime of smoking weed. It was ethereal. Mitch's insides were full of lightning and cold smoke. And he had never been so horny in his entire fucking life. As he clutched his manhood, he could feel his pulse throbbing. In perfect harmony, throbbing with the heartbeat in the wall. that misshapen, discolored doorway. It drew him, compelled him. Mitch stood before it, taking off his mask so that now he was completely naked, completely exposed. The wall vibrated. It hummed. It started to crack open in a fractal zigzag from bottom to top. Mitch rubbed himself against the wall, mashing it, making it sticky with his sweat, his saliva, his pre-cum. And an energy poured through that doorway, embracing him like a lover. No more tingles in his fingers and toes. This was something more. This was a caress, a touch, a breath in his ear, a shiver down his spine, times a million. This was the ultimate crime scene. And as horrible as it was, he couldn't bring himself to look away. Behind that crack in the wall was a window. A dirty, opaque window giving him an up-close and personal view of an island. The end of days. The foulest and most profane island in hell's vast black ocean. Populated with horrific demons and shrieking, mutilated victims. A voice slipped into Mitch's thoughts, putrid and poisonous. Let go. Mitch stopped stroking himself. He put his palms flat against the wall and stared through that dirty window. And you know what? He didn't need to touch himself. His lids fluttered, his eyes rolled back in his head as he was enveloped by pure sensation. Like hands on his flesh, the lover's touch he had never felt in life. A tickle behind the ear, a soft stroke on the back of his neck. His arms and legs felt like they were being deep tissue massaged as his nipples were tweaked and his balls were gently fondled. He was on the verge of an epic orgasm. And yet he fought it. He fought against it. He didn't want this feeling to end, any of it. And then he opened his eyes. And he saw that these feelings were no longer in his mind. It was not just a ghastly energy that embraced him. There were hands, severed human hands, dozens of them crawling over every inch of his flesh, touching him delicately, softly, scurrying across his skin. And his cock was swarming with little, tiny, baby hands. It was all too much, and Mitch erupted, coming like a thunderclap, blasting his seed across that window and collapsing, unconscious in a heap on the floor. When he woke minutes later, he was still trembling from the experience. The window was gone. His seed had been devoured by the mold. Was it growing a little thicker now, or was that his imagination? Was all of that his imagination? Mitch Kemp quickly dressed, put on his spit-soaked mask, and hurried out of the room. This had not merely been the greatest sexual experience of his life, but the greatest experience, period. He felt recharged, re-energized, and ready to get back to work. It was the perfect capper to a perfect vacation. And if this seems like a happy ending to you, consider this. After years of yearning and searching for this impossible fetish, Mitch had finally found it. The ultimate, the most intense feeling he could ever feel. He'd achieved it. He'd reached the top of the mountain. He'd found the Holy Grail. But now that it was over, how could he go back? How could he settle for anything less than the ultimate? And what might a man like Mitch Kemp do to get that feeling again? Almost anything. Thank you for listening to another episode of Scary Home Companion. Find the show on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, or email us directly at scaryhomecompanion@gmail.com. Join the show's Patreon page. You get extra episodes, bonus material, games, fun stuff, and anybody that is a patron or joins the Patreon in February of 2023 will be entered into a drawing to win a custom-made, hand-forged Damascus steel replica of the beautiful Death. The accursed blade that you witnessed in the episode called Gideon Hobbs and the Beautiful Death. Join the Patreon community, $5 a month on up, and you could win this piece of ghastly history. This episode was edited and produced by Jeff Baby Hands Davidson. It featured the music Social Capital by Glad Rags, Psycho Love by El Jugador, There Is No Such Thing as Safe Love by Jared Below, Restless States Constrained Desires by Daniel Birch, Swing with a Black Dog by Marak, Hot Train by my favorite group of all time, King Kong Ding Dong, and, as always, Chelsea Oxendine with the theme music.